Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of Nation of Writers. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our new virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can find and explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Margaret Wise Brown, the children's author of classics such as Goodnight Moon and The Runaway Bunny. Margaret's books have sold millions of copies all over the world, but few people know that she was at the center of the children's book publishing revolution. Her whimsy and imagination fueled a steady stream of stories, book ideas, songs, and poems, and she was renowned for her prolific writing and business savvy, as well as her stunning beauty and endless thirst for adventure. Today we are joined by writer and editor Amy Gary. In 1990, Gary discovered unpublished manuscripts and songs from Margaret Wise Brown tucked away in a trunk in the attic of Margaret's sister's barn. Since then, Gary has cataloged, edited, and researched all of Margaret's writings. She has worked with several publishers to publish more than 100 of those manuscripts, which include bestsellers and Caldecott nominees. Amy's work on Margaret has been covered in Vanity Fair, Entertainment Weekly, and on NPR. Her biography on Margaret, In the Great Green Room, was published by Flatiron Books, a division of Macmillan, and was named the best book of the year by Amazon when it was published. She was formerly the director of publishing at Lucasfilm and headed the publishing department at Pixar Animation Studios. In addition to writing, she packages books for retailers and consults with publishers. In that capacity, she has worked with Sam's Wholesale, Books A Million, Sterling Publishers, and Charles Schultz Creative Associates. Gary is interviewed by Nate King, Digital Content Associate for the American Writers Museum.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk about Margaret Wise Brown. She was just an amazing person and an incredible writer that touched generations of readers.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. I'm excited to get into it myself. I personally feel very connected to Margaret Wise Brown because I, as a little baby, got a little stuffed animal of the bunny from Goodnight Moon, and I named him Bunty, and he was like my my best friend. I took him everywhere. So I've always, without even knowing, Margaret Wise Brown has been a big impact on my life. Could you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got into her work, and what are you up to now?
Sure. So I've been in publishing and bookselling since I was 14 years old. So decades upon decades at this point. So, I was working with a publisher and met a couple of friends who wanted to start a small publishing company. And we wanted to start with doing children's books because children's books had just started on the rise at that point, being carried in bookstores in much higher quantities. And so we ended up starting to try to find things we could reprint. And I had a lot of librarian friends, children's librarian friends. And I just contacted all of them and said, hey, if I'm going to reprint children's books, because then you could, you know, sort of get the ball rolling faster. They said, hey, if you're going to reprint Margaret Wise Brown books, they're going out of print and they're amazing. So that's how I discovered who she was. But once I started reading, I realized she was my favorite author from childhood because The Color Kittens was my favorite children's book. So once you kind of get to know who she is, then you know more about how much she's actually touched so many different lives because she just had lots of different stories written under different names. So, but anyway, so that's kind of how we started. And I published I found her sister who had the rights to publish a lot of things and started doing reprints. And that's kind of how I got on the road to it.
Yeah, that's great. Can you tell me a little bit about about your book, the biography of
Sure. It's called In the Great Green Room, which is, of course, is one of the lines from Goodnight Moon. But it also was the color of one of her bedroom walls. She actually had stepped into a friend's apartment at some point and had seen this. She called it was like a Spanish painting because it was bright green, bright red, bright yellows. And she redid her own bedroom in that fashion. And that to me was an important line from it to have as the title. But I had worked with Margaret's things at that point for, you know, again, probably 30 years. And in 1990, I found a lot of her unpublished manuscripts, and her sister had literally put them into a trunk in the barn of her attic in Vermont. So they were, it was I'm surprised that they sustained themselves as well as they did. They were still kind of, you know, had some issues with them, but for the most part, they were really pristine. And we were able to go back and sort of see what was something that was publishable. And I've worked with those for many, many years. And also had received a lot of her letters and diaries, and or found them at that time at different libraries or within her papers. So I certainly knew a lot about her life, and it had always influenced how I edited those manuscripts that we found, because I was with the papers and the diaries, I was able to sort of track her life and know where she was with any particular story at any time. Not all of them, but some. That's not me snuffling, by the way. That's the dog. I apologize.
That's okay. Like we said in the beginning, Margaret Wise Brown would love animals.
She would. She had her dogs with her all the time, everywhere. So, in fact, she tried to teach when she was going to France on a trip. She tried to teach her dog French so that he would understand the commands from the people that were going to be around her. So
that's funny.
Anyway, and that was animals were a very big part of her life, by the way. And that was something that I certainly had in connection with her and with her sister. So, so anyway, it sort of came to be that I thought, you know, I've heard so much about this woman from all of her friends for so many years. And they were passing away fairly quickly, you know, at that time, because she died over 50 years ago. And so I thought, well, it's time to sort of really document who she was and put it into a form that's more readable. There's certainly lots of great stories and articles, and there's a wonderful biography by Leonard Marcus on her that gives a history of children's literature along the way. So there's all this great information out there, but really, I wanted people to see how her mind worked. And so while I initially wrote a biography that was, you know, more of a standard, you know, here's what happened here, and here's a quote from her here, I thought, what a better way to show who she was than to just jump into her mind and use all those letters and diaries, because she wrote lots of diaries and lots of letters, and put a person into her own mindset. Because it's fairly rare to be able to see that many letters and that many diaries available to really know what someone was thinking, know her emotions at a time. Because often when somebody's writing a letter, they are putting forward their best self. And right. Her diaries enabled me to see the true Margaret and her true thoughts. And so I hopefully did her justice by being able to sort of explain her thought process for writing and for living.
Yeah, that's great. What was, as a, you know, a fan of hers already, what was that experience like for you to go through her personal writing?
Sometimes I was a little disappointed in who she was, all honesty, because, you know, she was certainly lived a privileged life, you know, raised in New York City or the Brooklyn, and then the Long Island, and had family from Virginia, and just sort of thought of herself as a better U.S. citizen than other people. And that wasn't always, you know, that was a little bit difficult, but she, by the time I sort of came to the end of her life, she too had realized how wrong that thinking was. So, you know, we all get to grow in our own way, and she certainly did. And, tried to, the good of what she was trying to do certainly outweighed any of her lifestyle that she ended up trying to change. She was, for example, very much part of, or she believed in the America First idea for World War II, and didn't believe that they should go in and help in any way. And again, that was, you know, a very different thought process at the time, but But yeah, so there were times I was disappointed, but for the most part, it was just such a joy to be able to get in there and really explain how she thought, how she worked, and how she got to where she was with a lot of the process. And I hope that will inspire other readers and writers to sort of look at it and say, yeah, she was definitely, it was like this perfect storm. She was this very unique individual at a very unique time in the history of publishing, because all the war again had brought home all these baby boomers. And now we had this great market for children's books. And she really cashed in on it, and not necessarily just financially, although she would have been, she was one of the best paid writers at that time for sure. And, but also just, you know, being able to say, you know, I'm going to take advantage of radio. I'm going to take advantage of television. And unfortunately, she didn't live to see a lot of that completed, but she certainly started that process.
Maybe now's a good time. You kind of were doing it already, but to give our listeners a bit of context into the time period she was alive for, and, you know, when she started her career, I guess, you know, as far as, you know, publishing and then writing and teaching. But yeah, I don't know if you could maybe just give, I know you wrote a whole book about it, but maybe just give
So she started writing in the early 1930s. She got a job with Bank Street Educational, I think at that time it's called Laboratory, it's a school. And at that time, it was a progressive school, and they were bringing in different ways to educate children into the school and examining how other teachers taught. And that was very good for Margaret, because at the same time, Lucy, at the same time around the early, you know, 1930s, Lucy Sprague Mitchell was trying to have children's books be more, as she called them, democratic, because you could educate girls at that time. Girls and boys were educated separately. Girls got to a certain point and it was like, okay, now your math is going to be only at this level. And the boys kept growing and growing. And, you know, same thing with science. You were only going to learn this much, and the boys kept going. So girls would get to the point where becoming a medical doctor was almost impossible because you missed all that math, all that science. And so if you're going to have that be, if you were ever going to change it, but college level is too late. You can't fix it then. You had to change it at the ground level, at the kindergarten and elementary school level, and let girls and boys truly be educated equally. So that was simple to do with math and science. You could, you know, that's standard textbooks. But then you start bringing in textbooks that are written in, you know, with stories that are fairy tales and fables, telling girls that your ultimate goal should be to get married and have children. And then, you know, who wants a career, you know? So you had to change that narrative, and literally they changed that narrative. So they wrote stories that, you know, push the girls seeing boys as equals and boys seeing girls as equals. And so they did that not only through text, but through using animals. And that was a very much of a theme that continued on with Margaret's works. You know, furry animals were almost, I don't want to say exclusively her characters, because certainly she had others. But when she could, she did use different animals, because then any child could see themselves in that story. Girl, boy, you know, race didn't matter. You could be anybody and see yourself as the protagonist, you know, just as you saw Bunty is your best friend, he could have been my best friend, you know, so, right. You know, same thing. Mm-hmm. So that was the start. And then she just sort of kept going and going and going from there. So in terms of writing.
Yeah. And it was interesting too, to learn as I was doing my research about her, how she like, it was a kind of experimental, I guess, in her writing. And like you said, pushed the boundaries. But in what ways would you say that we still see that now, if any?
Well, in terms of just, you know, using the characters and so forth, you still see that today. But one of the more important things they did is they, rather than having children talked down to through stories, which was, you know, sort of the other way that you saw these stories, you know, you were given morals and, you know, you were told what to do. And this let children see themselves in a different way. So a couple of the ways in which she and Lucy, and all of the other writers at Bank Street, it wasn't just the two of them, but but certainly they sort of started this, as Lucy said, she had the idea, or she started the idea, but Margaret gave it wings, because she was able to really put those things into physical practice. So the here and now philosophy was, we're going to tell a child, we're going to reflect a child's life in their here and now. Here's what they think about at 3 years old. Here's what they think about at 6 years old. And we're going to give them stories that match that age level, their understanding, their emotional capabilities, And not only that, but their verbiage. So they would go in and make lists of, Margaret would take children down to the docks, for example, and watch how they spoke to the captain of the ship or saw things, and would make notes on different age, different words they would use at different ages. So she'd take a group of 8-year-olds. What were the words that they used to describe that event? And that way they were able to make long lists of words that children knew at that time and use themselves and could reflect that back to them in their stories. She would throw in challenging words at times, a little bit older word, a little bit more difficult, you know, multiple syllables, just to sort of, you know, change things up. But she did that was not done at that time. Now we, of course, know what reading levels are and know how to use those in publishing. And you know, if you're going to publish for an 8-year-old, you want it to be 8-year-old language. And but they didn't have that then. So there's these long list of words to describe a farm or whatever that children use. And she would use those in her writing, create them and use them.
Yeah. It's like a scientific process, which I found neat. But that's also because the kind of the whole approach of the school is sort of taking a scientific approach to teaching kids, which turns out we need, you know. And you going into that her process there, a little bit of, you know, spending time with kids and everything like that. I found it interesting too that you shared with me those photos of one of which is, you know, she would send different lines to the illustrators to, you know, that were all kind of interchangeable lines, right?
Okay. So one of the things that Margaret would do that's different from how we publish today is she was almost an art director as well as the writer. She worked very closely with her illustrators. We certainly don't do that now. We allow illustrators their own ability to process the materials. The writer, you know, comes up with what they want. The illustrator then is able to take that, see their own vision, and create it. And if you have a writer trying to tell the illustrator what they should be doing, you're limiting their ability to truly create you're knocking something out of that process. You're taking away from them their ability to be the artist, the illustrator. But Margaret didn't hesitate to do that back in the day. So she would actually not only would she give different lines to different illustrators to use as they were inspired to do. So she would have a long list of, you know, you can use these lines instead, or she'd come back and say, you know, I don't like what you did there. How about if we do this? It was a very interactive process for her with her illustrators. But she also, as I said, acted as art director many times, because she would go in and actually illustrate a whole book on her own and say, this is what I want you to do with this book. And then she would just turn it over to somebody who actually was an artist and then them produce it that way. So she had lots of dummy books that she would do that way, or she would even nowadays, of course, when we're creating a book dummy, what we do is we say on page this is the text that's going to be here. She would send them a text, a dummy as well, and let them go back and forth in terms of, you know, what should be a spread or what shouldn't be. And nowadays, sometimes an illustrator will choose those instead, but she was not just a little bit involved. She was heavily involved in every one of her books. In fact, there was one example where she wanted to do a book that had illuminating stars that were would illuminate at night. What do you call it? Glow in the dark.
Yeah.
So she even went as far as finding a printer that could print with that kind of ink. So she was, you know, writer, art director, and in some ways publisher for a lot of
Wow. that sort of story just reminds me of a lot of the, I guess the kind of sense I got of her was that she was kind of always different, or, you know, always out there, even as a kid, from what I could understand. She was always a little peculiar perhaps, but
and pushy too, which is, you know,
pushy.
her father did her a great service in letting her be who she was. At the time, certainly little girls were expected to sit and sew or read books, but she did not do that. She instead really enjoyed going out and being in nature as much as she could be. And her father recognized that and not only physically gave her the ability to do it on the at the house where they lived, but he took her out fishing. He took it with just whatever interest, golfing, fishing, swimming. He encouraged her to be independent, I think mostly because he had some sisters who were not raised that way. And sort of, he was still supporting them financially, and it bothered him that they never kind of got on their own two feet. And he expected all of his children to go in and to support themselves and not to depend on others. So it was a mental game for him to, you know, make sure that Margaret had what she needed to survive in the world. And she did.
Yeah. I think one quote I read of hers maybe was something along the lines of, you know, she counted her friends as like a few cats and some bunnies and all the dogs she could gather together.
They really did not have, they lived in an area at the time, Long Island was spacious, let's say, right, to say the least. Yeah. So, you know, her sister describes about literally walking to this, you know, one room schoolhouse where they went, and how Margaret would dawdle the whole way. And you know, Roberto would become so frustrated because Margaret could sit still and just look at a bee moving around for, you know, an hour. And it bothered her sister immensely.
Yeah. That does kind of make me think, though, going back to the here and now too, is the focus on ordinary things, which I, you know, found fascinating that kids are kind of more interested in that than adults are, because they, you know, they don't have necessarily the concepts of imagination yet. So they just use these things right in front of them to play with or just be interested in. As I was reading it, it made me think of Goodnight Moon, of course, or when my dad would read it, he would just like point to things, and then he would also just say things that weren't in the picture, and then we'd have to like try to find it. But it was normal things that could be in a room, you know.
Yeah.
And it definitely brought me back. I was like, oh yeah, it's just a Goodnight Moon. I guess I'll use the example. It's just a story of seeing objects and saying goodnight to them. But
it's also patterns. It's a pattern. One of the great things about Margaret's writing that I think has one of the reasons it stands the test of time is she developed really good patterns for readers. So Goodnight Moon is a pattern, as you know, you've seen all these, you know, Goodnight Bush, you know, Goodnight Computer, you've seen all those things, right, play off of that. But she, in her very first iteration of Goodnight Moon, was actually in a textbook, and it was a much shorter version. And she also wrote the teacher's manual that would go with that particular part of the textbook. And she was encouraging the children in that teacher's aide to make up their own patterns. Like, what do you say goodnight to? What do you say good morning to? Now let's turn it into a good morning story. So she had that, she would use that pattern over and over again. And it, as most people may or may not know, that what book was not all that successful when it was initially published. It certainly has found its feet since then, but her pattern, I think, is really what is inspiring there, because it is so lulling, and it is so, if you're trying to give a child a sense of security, what a perfect way to do it. But that was also a game that she and her sister played at night. They would say goodnight to the different things in their room. And even when she was a teenager, there's a portion of her diary, and her parents had been remodeling a house or building a house, and they finally moved into the new house. All of the stuff that was in storage that she hadn't seen since she went off to boarding school. So this is now, things have been in storage for a couple, 3 years or whatever. She comes back and all of those things are in her bedroom, and she's going through and as a teenager is going through and basically saying goodnight, you know, looking at the little book that she used to love. So it was a calming technique for herself. So what a better way to share it?
Yeah, that's great. Made me want to switch gears a little bit. I've also heard, or not heard, but read, you know, her life outside of the realm of publishing and writing was quite the life as well. You know, going on lots of trips, very extravagant, lots of romance, and romance gone wrong, I guess. But
yes.
I don't know if you have any sort of, if you want to give an encapsulation of that.
I'd love
or
to, I love how she lived. And, you know, I think that's one of the other reasons that, her, again, that her, it's reflected in her writing, because, you know, she is all in when she's writing something. She is studying it. She is she's getting to know how, you know, if she's going to write about potato farmers, she's going to go visit a potato farm. And that sort of sense of curiosity that just lived in her and her creativity. Every person I spoke to that knew her personally said she was the most creative person they had ever met. And this was a bunch of creative people saying this. So, wow. So that says a lot, but she also could be exhausting. I tend to think as well, because, you know, she was always, you know, on a go, go, go level. And didn't hesitate to challenge people's thoughts or whatever. But her love life, I mean, she loved who she loved, and she did not make she made no apologies for it, because she, now I think her friends tried to make apologies for the relationships, which was, to me, it was sort of like, you know, she when you read how much she loved Michael Strange, her who was born Blanche Ulrichs, you see what dedication she had to this person who was not always kind to her. And it was sort of frustrating to read the letters back from Michael to Margaret, sort of denigrating her work or her looks or her voice. And those things were very frustrating to look at, but I certainly understood her love of the people that she loved. And, you know, she lived at a time when gender construct was just a given. You know, you were expected to do this, you were expected to do that. And she was like, right. Not going to do it. And just lived how she wanted to live and empowered herself in that way. Didn't hold back. When she fell in love, she fell fully in love. And she loved men, she loved women, and that's just who she was. And it was so nice to be able to bring that part of the story to life, hopefully in a way that made it understandable for people who have trouble with that for a children's book author. I mean, the idea that a children's book author has to live above the rest of us in a different way or something is ridiculous.
So. Right. Yeah. Were a lot of those that sort of personal side in the letters and diaries that you found?
She very much talked about those things, and also she has a lot of great adult poetry, which I've tried to have published through a couple of different publishers. Haven't had it done yet, so I think we're maybe with all the new interest again back in Margaret, and hopefully there'll be a documentary on her soon. I think a couple of people are working on different things. So maybe with all of that, these adult poems where she talks about what it feels like to be looking at the person you love across the room and knowing that within this crowd, you can't acknowledge that love and how frustrating that was.
Wow. Yeah.
And so those are some of her most incredible work. She also has a sense of humor about some of it. She has a poem called He and She, and it's like, you know, you take a he and you put him on another he, then adds up to 1, 2, 3 or so. It's she plays with those ideas. And she also has secret little stories that she would write for Michael, where it reflected their own life. The Peppermints was about really their domestic life and naming their dog and having peppermint tea in the evening together or something, you know, just all these little things that I know she was very happy to have in those stories.
Yeah. You talking about the letters and the poetry made me think too, do you see sort of different writing styles or different voice based on, say, letter or diary? And then of course the children's books would be different, or maybe not. I don't know. Yeah.
No, she did. She even created different writing styles for different publishers. And that was very smart, because you had Harper, who had typical picture books, you know, they're the nice big trade, you know, beautiful books, and still are, you know, they certainly cover a wide gamut, but they weren't the mass market publisher that Golden Books was at the time. And so she had a specific style that she wrote in for Golden Books and had a different name, Golden McDonald, that she wrote under with that publisher. And wow. You could see how she would take a particular idea, and if one publisher passed on it, she would rewrite it for another publisher in their style, because mass market books would have a different page count or a different illustration. Or really, they started getting into the book plus, or the, you know, like, we're going to put a book with a bunny, or we're going to put a book with a. So she started doing some of that at the end of her life. She had an idea, for example. She was sitting in a town square with a clock tower, and she thought, you know, I could come up with a book to help a child learn how to tell time, and we could put a little watch in there. And she got a quote on having these little strappy watches that she could put into the book for Golden, and had all these other ideas for, you know, ballets and plays and television shows. And she had the idea to have two different reading hours on the radio for children, one at nap time and then one at nighttime. And you would have somebody read something that was sort of naptime oriented or bedtime oriented, and came up with a song to go along with the opening. I mean, she had the whole thing sort of figured out, and had a Mother Goose television idea, and wow. Had, you know, so she really did keep moving all those things forward, pressing those boundaries every way she could.
Yeah. And then, cause she passed away young, right?
She was 42 years old.
Yeah.
And, so it was a sudden death. What happened was she had gone to France to meet with some movie producers, and hopefully to create some things for the stage as well, the stage producers, movie producers. And she was engaged at the time to Pebble Rockefeller, who's still alive, and gave me lots of great information for the books, and passed on some wonderful papers to her university. And his, you know, he's still cute as he can be, so I can understand why she fell madly in love with him. But she had they initially thought it might be an appendicitis attack, and that, or something else. And so they went in to do surgery and kept her lying flat. And I saw several phone calls and letters and so forth to her doctor, asking if they would let her get up and move around, because she felt like it was wrong to just lay flat. Mm-hmm. But they made her stay still in France at the time. And unfortunately, when they did release her, a blood clot had built up in her leg, and it cut loose and it killed her almost instantly. And she was 42 years old and was supposed to be meeting Pebble at the place where they were to be married in the Caribbean. And instead of going to pick her up at the dock, he instead received this telegram telling him that she had passed away. So it was a shock for everyone, because she was so full of life. They just couldn't conceive that she would die.
Right. Yeah. And she's, you know, when you mentioning radio and TV, all the new sort of technology that she was mm-hmm. at the time, it seems like she was on the cusp of doing even more for her kids and reading.
Yeah. She had record. Now she not only had her publishing deals, she had record deals. So she had a record deal with Columbia, and then Young People's Records. And she was taking all of her old material, gotten all of her music rights back, and was now, you know, pushing it out to the marketplace for records. And again, like I said, television shows and radio shows. But she also was trying to write music for adults at the same time. And oh, wow. Had one actually made it to, as she said, the jukebox. So, so I guess it meant popular music.
Yeah. Wow, that's neat. It's got me thinking a little bit. Like, I always like to ask this question, and feel free to decline if you want, because it's always tough to say. But like, if she were alive today, how do you think she'd be engaging with our current world? And like, how do you think?
I definitely think this would be such a great world for her, because she had so many amazing ideas that really were physically not possible to produce mm-hmm. way back when, just dollar wise, or, you know, the idea of having to go and find your own printer to do this specific ink. She would absolutely have loved the electronic aspect to everything. She would have loved how children, and she would have found it very humorous, all the Goodnight Moon stuff. I'm certain of that, all the different takeoffs. She would just have thought that hilarious. But I think that just more than anything, this, she was so ahead of her time. And when you think about the idea that, again, breaking those gender roles and not accepting them, we don't, you know, we're kind of there in many ways now. We still got a long ways to go, I know, but we're so far advanced compared to when she was struggling with all of that. And how nice it would be to be able to live fully in her body the way that she, in her mind, the way that she would have. I would have loved that for her. But just also just because the technology finally caught up with that brilliant mind. Right. I've mentioned this before about a particular book. I don't know if I wrote about it in the biography or not, but there was one manuscript that more than any others made me realize the brilliance of Margaret. She had something called North, South, East, West, which we've actually now done in a regular picture book. But the way in which she had it crafted as a dummy was it was bound on four sides and then cross cut in the middle so that you could read it in the round, opening the flaps, you know, of the story, opening it up, reading North, South, East, West, and going around in all the directions. But the way in which she wrote the story is it read in the round. But each story also read, like each section, north also was a poem in itself. East was also a poem in itself.
Wow.
And just to think about how you could write in that way to make everything sort of match up. It's like, oh, wow, that's brilliant. And then when you got to the bottom of the story or the book, you opened all the pages up, this barn, this paper barn that she made or had someone make pops up. And it has a weather vane that spins on a toothpick. Whoa. And that was her idea of how to physically produce that book. I mean, even now it'd be a fortune to make that, but certainly we couldn't bind on four sides easily way back then.
Yeah. Yeah. That definitely is her mind far beyond what was capable at that time, which is interesting. Before we kind of wrap things up, I was curious if you have any favorite letters or journals or journal entries that you came across, or any favorite stories of hers that you heard in your research?
Well, I think one of my favorite this is such a culmination of Margaret stories, is there's a poem called Cherry Tree, which we've included in one of the Goodnight Song books, Celebration of the Seasons. And now we put it to music. But Cherry Tree was this poem it's beautiful. And it talks about how at some point this child is lying on the ground looking up at the cherry trees, but now the birds are all fled. And sort of like the seasons of the life sort of changing. And but the reason that one's so important or touches me so much is she heard a song called The Time of the Cherries when she was in school in Switzerland as a child. And the story touched her so much. It's a song that became part of the French Revolution at some point, where the battle is going on. And there's a nurse who's in white who ends up getting shot. And she's lying under these cherry trees. And the splashing juice of the cherry trees is around her, along with this red on her white uniform. And it's a song that just sort of touches so many people, because you realize how, you know, we get into these phases of war and how we forget what's really important and the life that's around us. And so she tried to find this song and couldn't find it. Finally asked a friend to see if she could help her find this old ballad she'd heard. And the friend found it, and Margaret sets it to two or three different versions of poetry. And it's such a perfect Margaret story. It's like this, I remember this word, this song, this word pattern. It touched me so much. How could I use that to explain sort of like the changing seasons of our lives? And it was right at the time where Michael, her partner, had passed away from leukemia. And it also, so personally, it was a time that she needed, it was a way in which she could express this loss that she was feeling, and yet also sort of celebrate the beauty of the world that we live in. So that's my favorite piece by her, I think.
Yeah, that, That makes sense. I love that. That's a great story. Well, I wanted to thank you for joining me, Amy. Do you have anything else about Margaret Wise Brown or yourself that you wanted to touch on?
I am looking forward to having people continue to discover her. She's such a fascinating person and really did change such a revolutionary that in terms of children's literature that I don't want to say she's unsung because certainly people know her work, but the way in which she altered the world, I don't know where children's publishing would be today without her.
Right. Yeah. Well said. Thanks again.
Nice to meet you. Thanks again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.